There was no answer to the front door, and Mark almost turned away and went back into the village, feeling a touch of relief and a lightening of heart that he recognised as cowardice. So, instead, he jumped down off the veranda and went around the side of the house. The stiff collar and tie chafed his throat, and the jacket felt unnatural and constricting, so that he shrugged his shoulders and ran a finger around inside his collar as he came into the kitchen yard of the cottage. It was 5 months since last he had worn clothes or trodden on a paved sidewalk. Even the sound of women's voices was unfamiliar. He paused and listened to them. Marion Littlejohn was in the kitchen with her sister, and their merry prattle had a lilt and cadence to which he listened with new ears and fresh pleasure. The chatter ceased abruptly at his knock, and Marion came to the door. She wore a gaily striped apron, and her bare arms were flowery to the elbows. She had her hair up in a ribbon, but tendrils of it had come down in little wisps onto her neck and forehead. The kitchen was filled with the smell of baking bread, and her cheeks were rosy from the heat of the oven. "Mark," she said calmly, "how nice," and tried to push the curl of hair off her forehead, leaving a smudge of white flour on the bridge of her nose. It was a strangely appealing gesture, and Mark felt his heart swell. "Come in." She stood aside and held the door open for him. Her sister greeted Mark frostily, much more aware of the jilting than Marion herself. "Doesn't he look well?" Marion asked, and they both looked Mark over carefully as he stood in the centre of the kitchen floor. "He's too thin," her sister judged him waspishly, and began untying her apron strings. "Perhaps," Marion agreed comfortably. "Perhaps he just needs proper food." And she smiled and nodded as she saw how brown and lean he was, but she recognised also, with eyes as fond as a mother's, the growing weight of maturity in his features. She saw also the sorrow and the loneliness, and she wanted to take him in her arms and hold his head against her bosom. "There's some lovely buttermilk," she said instead. "Sit down here where I can see you." While she poured from the jug, her sister hung the apron behind the door, and without looking at Mark, said primly, "We need more eggs. I'll go into the village." When they were alone, Marion picked up the roller and stood over the table, leaning and dipping, as the pastry spread and rolled out paper thin. "Tell me what you've been doing," she invited. And he began hesitantly at first, but with blossoming sureness and enthusiasm, to tell her about Charker's Gate, about the work and the life he had found there. "That's nice." She punctuated his glowing account every few minutes, her mind running busily ahead, already making lists and planning supplies, adapting pragmatically to the contingencies of a life lived far from the comforts of civilization, where even the small comforts become luxuries. A glass of fresh milk, a light in the night, all of it has to be planned for and carefully arranged. Characteristically, she felt neither excitement nor dismay at the prospect. She was of pioneer stock. Where a man goes, the woman follows. It was merely work that must be done. "The site for the homestead is up in the first fold of the hills, but you can see right down the valley, and the cliffs of Charker's Gate are right above it. It's beautiful, especially in the evenings." "I'm sure it is. I've designed the house so it can be added onto, a room at a time. To begin with, there will only be two rooms." "Two rooms will be enough to begin with," she agreed, frowning thoughtfully. "But we'll need a separate room for the children." He broke off and stared at her, not quite certain that he had heard correctly. She paused with the rolling pin held in both hands and smiled at him. "Well, that's why you came here today, isn't it?" she asked sweetly. He dropped his eyes from hers and nodded. "Yes," he sounded bemused. "I suppose it is." She lost her aplomb only briefly during the ceremony, and that was when she saw General Sean Courtney sitting in the front pew with his wife beside him, Sean in morning suit and with a diamond pin in his cravat, Ruth cool and elegant in a huge wagon-wheel-sized hat, the brim thick with white roses. "He came," Marion whispered ecstatically, and could not restrain the triumphant glance she threw to her own friends and relatives, like a lady tossing a coin to a beggar. Her social standing had rocketed to dizzying heights. Afterwards, the general had bussed her tenderly on each cheek before turning to Mark. "You've picked the prettiest girl in the village, my boy." And she had glowed with pleasure, pink and happy and truly as lovely as she had ever been in her life. With the help of the four Zulu labourers Sean had given him, Mark had opened a rough track in as far as the Bubezi River. He brought his bride to Chaka's gate on the pillion of the motorcycle, with the sidecar piled high with part of her dowry. Far behind them, the Zulus led Trojan and Spartan under heavy packs, the rest of Marian's baggage. In the early morning, the mist lay dense along the river, still and flat as the surface of a lake, touched to shades of delicate pink and mauve by the fresh new light of coming day. The great headlands of Chaka's Gate rose sheer out of the mist, dark and mysterious, each wreathed in laurels of golden cloud. Mark had chosen the hour of return so that she might have the best of it for her first glimpse of her new home. He pulled the cycle and sidecar off the narrow, stony track and switched off the motor. In the silence they sat and watched the sun strike upon the crests of the cliffs, burning like the beacons that the mariner looks for in the watery deserts of the ocean, the lights that beckon him to his landfall and the quiet anchorage. "It's very nice, dear," she murmured. "Now show me where the house will be." She worked with the Zulus, muddy to the elbows as they puddled the clay for the unburnt Kimberley bricks, joshing them in their own language and bullying them cheerfully to effort beyond the usual pace of Africa. She worked behind the mules, handling the traces, dragging up the logs from the valley, her sleeves rolled high on brown, smooth arms, and a scarf knotted around her head. She worked over the clay oven, bringing out the fat golden brown loaves on the blade of a long-handled spade, and watched with deep contentment as Mark wiped up the last of the stew with the crust. "Was that good then, dear?" In the evening she sat close to the lantern with her head bowed over the sewing in her lap, and nodded brightly as he told her of the day's adventures, each little triumph and disappointment. "Oh, what a shame, dear," or "How nice for you, dear." He took her, one bright, cloudless day, up the ancient pathway to the crest of Chaka's Gate, holding her hand as he led her over the narrow places, where the river flowed 600 sheer feet below their feet. She tucked her skirts into her bloomers, took a firm hold on the basket she carried, and never faltered once on the long climb. On the summit, he showed her the tumbled stone walls and overgrown caves of the old tribesmen who had defied Chaka, and he told her the story of the old king's climb, pointing to the fearsome path up which he had led his warriors. And finally he described the massacre, and pictured for her the rain of human bodies hurled down into the river below. "How interesting, dear," she murmured, as she spread a cloth from the basket she had carried. "I brought scones and some of that apricot jam you like so much." Something caught Mark's eye, unusual movement far down in the valley below, and he reached for his binoculars. In the golden grass at the edge of the tall reed beds, they looked like a line of fat black bugs on a clean sheet. He knew what they were immediately, and with a surging uplift of excitement, he counted them. 18! He shouted aloud. "It's a new herd. What is it, dear?" She looked up from the scone she was spreading with jam. "It's a new herd of buffalo," he exulted. "They must have come in from the north. It's beginning to work already." In the field of the binoculars he saw one of the great bovine animals emerge into the clearing in the long grass. He could see not only its wide black back, but the heavy head and spreading ears beneath the mournful drooping horns. The sunlight caught the bosses of the polished black horns so that they glittered like gunmetal. He felt an enormous proprietary pride. They were his own, the first to come into the sanctuary he was building for them. "Look," he offered her the binoculars, and she wiped her hands carefully and pointed the glasses over the cliff. "There on the edge of the swamp," he pointed, with the pride and joy shining on his face. "I can see them," she agreed, smiling happily for him. "How nice, dear." Then she swung the binoculars in a wide sweep across the river, to where the roof of the homestead showed above the trees. "Doesn't it look so nice with its new thatch?" she said proudly. "I just can't wait to move in." The following day they moved up from the shack of crude thatch and canvas at the old camp under the sycamore fig trees, and a pair of swallows moved in with them. The swiftly darting birds began to build their neat nest with little shiny globs of mud under the eaves of the new yellow thatch against the crisply whitewashed wall of Kimberley brick. "That's the best of all possible luck," Mark laughed. Oh, they make such a mess, said Marion doubtfully. But that night, for the first time ever, she initiated their lovemaking. Rolling comfortably onto her back in the double bed, drawing up her nightdress to her waist and spreading her warm womanly thighs.
It's all right if you want to, dear.
And because she was kind and loved him so, he was as quick and as considerate as he could be.
Was that good then, dear?
It was wonderful, he told her. And he had a sudden vivid image of a lovely, vital woman, with a body that was lithe and swift and his guilt was brutal, like a fist below the heart. He tried to thrust the image away, but it ran ahead of him through his dreams, laughing and dancing and teasing, so that in the morning there were dark blue smears beneath his eyes, and he felt fretful and restless. I'm going up the valley on patrol. He did not look up from his coffee.
But you only came back last Friday.
She was surprised. I want to look for those buffalo again, he said.
Very well, dear, I'll pack your bag. How long will you be gone? I'll put in your sweater and the jacket. It's cool in the evenings.
It's a good thing I baked yesterday. She prattled on cheerfully, and he had a sudden terrible urge to shout at her to be silent.
It'll give me a chance to plant out the garden. It'll be nice to have fresh vegetables again, and I haven't written a letter for ages. They'll be wondering about us at home.
He rose from the table and went out to saddle Trojan. The flogging explosion of heavy wings roused Mark from his reverie, and he straightened in the saddle just as a dozen of the big birds rose from the edge of the reed beds. They were those dirty, buff-coloured vultures, powering upwards as they were disturbed by Mark's approach, and undergoing that almost magical transformation from gross ugliness into beautiful, plaining flight. Mark tethered Trojan and slipped the mannlicher from its scabbard as a precaution. He felt a tickle of excitement. Hopes high that he had come upon a kill by one of the big predatory cats, perhaps even a lion, one of the animals for which he still searched the valley in vain. The buffalo lay at the edge of the damp, soft ground, half hidden by the reeds, and it was so freshly dead that the vultures had not yet managed to penetrate the thick black hide, nor to spoil the sign which was deeply trodden and torn into the damp earth. They had only gouged out the uppermost eye, and with their beaks scratched the softer skin around the bull's anus, for that was always their access point to a big, thick-skinned carcass. The buffalo was a big mature bull, the great boss of his horns grown solidly together across the crown of his skull, a huge head of horn, 48 inches from tip to tip. He was big in the body also, bigger than a prize Hereford stud bull, and he was bald across the shoulders, the scarred grey hide scabbed with dried mud and bunches of bush ticks. Mark thrust his hand into the crease of skin between the back legs and felt the residual body warmth. He's been dead less than 3 hours, he decided, and squatted down beside the huge body to determine the cause of death. The bull seemed unmarked until Mark managed to roll him over, exerting all his strength and using the stiffly outthrust limbs to move the ton and a half of dead weight. He saw immediately the death wounds. One was behind the shoulder, through the ribs, and Mark's hunter's eye saw instantly that it was a heart stroke, a wide-lipped wound, driven home deeply. The clotted heart blood that poured from it had jellied on the damp earth. If there was any doubt at all as to the cause of that injury, it was dispelled instantly when he looked to the second wound. This was a frontal stroke, at the base of the neck, angled in skilfully between bone, to reach the heart again, and the weapon had not been withdrawn. It was still plunged into the hilt, and the shaft was snapped short where the bull had fallen upon it. Mark grasped the broken shaft, placed one booted foot against the bull's shoulder, and grunted with the effort it required to withdraw the blade against the reluctant suck of clinging flesh.